1000.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, wildfires in the mountains consume tens of thousands of acres and fill Charlotte's air with smoke. The governor's race remains too close to call. How that might play out, even as the toxicology report on Keith Scott is released, raising more questions. WFAE is denied access to video from a different police shooting. Some Carolina folks could be in contention for possible positions in Donald Trump's cabinet, and cats goes new car shopping. Well, streetcar shopping. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and we're joined today by WFAE's Lisa Wharf. This is your first time, isn't it?
This is my first time on a full-fledged news roundup, yes.
All right, well, jump in there.
Uh-huh.
Yes, fight these guys now. Let's see who else is here. Glenn Berkins is back. He's editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And our two Erics are here. Eric Spanberg with a K, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Eric with a C. Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for joining us too, guys.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
The haze that we've been seeing this week is from smoke up in the mountains that's drifting down from where wildfires have been burning tens of thousands of acres. I'm told that the Chimney Rock area is opening to residents again, I think tomorrow. They can go back. But they closed our airport here for a period this week because of visibility problems. It looks, as I look out this window this morning, like it's clearer than it has been. Doesn't mean that it's completely clear, but is our air quality now improving, or do we know?
Seems like it's too early to tell, but it sure looks better today. But
we're all looking out the window.
Yeah, we're.
I'm not a meteorologist, but I play one on TV. Yeah.
the ratings seem to be better than on Wednesday. Wednesday seemed to be the real dicey one, and I think it finally permeated. The smell permeated the buildings, and so I could smell it Thursday inside. Yeah. But
Watching the Panthers game, the air looked crystal clear last night on the aerial shot, so I thought maybe they recorded those weeks ago. Who knows? We talked about this yesterday at length, but one thing we didn't talk about is what all of this is costing the state. I never even thought about this. We did a whole 35-minute segment on this yesterday, but we burned through $10 million fighting these fires so far with little or nothing to show for it because these are going to continue to burn into December, possibly January. Where's that money coming from? Anybody know?
Oh, I guess you can't. Can you declare that like a federal emergency or disaster kind of thing?
Has it been declared that?
I don't believe it.
It hasn't. I'm not sure. I don't know if it can. But if it can, that sure would be helpful to offset some of that.
Wouldn't that come from the rainy day fund, which has been discussed so much? I don't know. I'm just... Yeah. I shouldn't say rainy day fund when we need rain so badly, but you know what I mean.
We're putting out fires
on rainy
our rainy day.
That's right, exactly. Yes.
And no rain is in the forecast. This weekend is going to bring a little relief from the smoke here because a cold front is going to push out whatever we can't see because it's still in the atmosphere. We just can't see it. But that cold front comes with high gusty winds in the mountains, which is liable to fan the flames yet again. We're talking about 25 to 30 miles per hour, and some authorities in these mountains say that some of these blazes may have been set. They're investigating. Governor McCrory has issued a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of people who started these fires. How likely are we to be able to find a culprit in this, and how would that culprit be punished?
I would think that's pretty unlikely. I mean, you're talking about rural areas where, you know, you could be standing there with a match and there's nobody within sight for miles. I mean, how do you find that guy?
Yeah. That's true. But in some cases out west, they've actually made arrests for people who started wildfires in California and some other states. And I've always wondered, how do you know? Because you're right. Who sees it? But
yeah.
Criminals have a tendency to talk.
Yeah, but I would say the second part, not knowing, you know, what the actual legal statute is, if you're caught doing that and the state has spent $10 million, my guess is it's going to be a pretty severe punishment, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, this is happening because we have a severe drought in the mountains. And now, I think yesterday afternoon, Charlotte was included as being officially in drought. I thought we were already in stage one drought in Charlotte because lake levels and river levels are low and they've closed some boat ramps, et cetera. But we are now officially in drought. Have they issued any requests to not water lawns, not wash cars? No. Have we gotten to that far yet?
I know since November 1, there's been voluntary requests not to water lawns and things like that. But I haven't heard of any this week that have come out. I know that a bunch of boat ramps have been closed at Lake Norman and some of the county parks just because things are low. Yeah.
Well, and when you look at just the state, when you cut it in half, I mean, you have one half that has been absolutely ravaged by the hurricane and the rains and the other side that's being ravaged by the drought. I mean, it really is the worst of all possible circumstances.
Yeah.
Did I dream it or did we not get a substantial amount of rain during the hurricane as well?
But not enough to make up for the deficit. I think we're 6 or 7
inches. Just one day, slow rain. So
maybe it was just my health.
FEMA, just going back to the fires in the mountains, FEMA has approved the governor's request for financial assistance, which will pay for 75% of the emergency protective measures taken. Another example of the federal government interfering with things. let's move on to Keith Scott. The chief state medical examiner released autopsy and toxicology reports on police shooting a victim, Keith Scott, this week. What did those reports tell us?
I don't think they told us things that were too unexpected. We knew he was taking a lot of medications. He was dealing with a disorder, the brain injury. The brain injury. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I mean, there were anticonvulsants he was taking and relaxants and things like that. The thing that was striking to us in the newsroom is that we thought, okay, where's reports of marijuana in this? And found out that he hadn't been tested for marijuana.
Why not?
And that's – well
– First of all
– Well, first,
let's
it's significant.
Let's back up. Let's back up. And why would that even be something that would –
Yes. So this is – significant because, I mean, police have said one of the reasons they approached him was this – or the reason they approached him was this combination of he was rolling a joint and he had a gun out. And so that sidetracked their warrant serving or their arrest, and so you'd think, right, if that was such a big part of the case, that would be requested from either CMPD or the State Board of or the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigation. But it seems like that wasn't the case.
Did they recover the joint? Do they have the joint in custody in the evidence lockup?
There has been a picture of it. They did release
a
picture.
So had it been lit?
I just saw a picture. It was hard to tell. It didn't appear to have
been. Because maybe that's why they didn't test. Maybe it was never lit.
Well, but even if it wasn't lit, I'm assuming that maybe he had
consumed previously,
and that might show up to build their case.
Yeah. Well, it also seems like you would want to check. If this is the main genesis of your concern, you would want to check and see, okay, well, what is in his system?
Yeah. It seems like somebody dropped the ball there.
I find that hard to imagine.
No reason why that shouldn't have been
done.
Yeah,
that doesn't make sense.
Is it too late now to go back and test for that? Do we know? We're not doctors, obviously.
I don't know.
No, I'm a meteorologist, so I don't know.
So no explanation as to why they didn't test.
Yeah, CMPD said, you know, get in touch with the SBI because they're in charge of the investigation. They stepped in a couple days after the shooting and left it at that.
An independent autopsy as well, and I was wondering if they had tested him for marijuana or some other illegal substance.
Well, the state's autopsy confirmed the other results of the private autopsy in terms of where he was shot and what might have killed him and the fact that there were anticonvulsants and sedatives that his family had said he was taking in his system. But I don't know anything about marijuana testing.
Yeah, that question occurred to me too, and I was trying to look for that answer, and I couldn't find it.
Have we had any discussion of – you know, the medications that he's now confirmed to have been on, how that may have affected his behavior in terms of how he responded to the police? I would assume that's a question at some point. Maybe it's unanswerable. I don't know.
No. What does this mean for the case? Now that they've done these two autopsies, the toxicology report has come back, et cetera. The video has been released. Does this close it? Is it over now, or is there more to come?
well, we're still waiting for the SBI to say what's going to happen. Are there going to be charges or are they going to clear him? So, I mean, CMPD said they thought it was a pretty clear-cut case. But, you know, at this point, I haven't heard any indication when that might come down. Mm.
Meanwhile, Charlotte protesters have filed suit against the city and CMPD chief Kerr Putney. It involves seven people, Eric Spanberg, and they aren't suing for damages. What are they trying to achieve?
So this is interesting. They filed this suit late last month, and they filed it asking for, in essence, a change in tactics, pepper spray and rubber bullets and all the things that the protesters said escalated the protests uptown and north of the city. And originally, when this was filed, which was the last weekend, next to last weekend in October, they asked for an immediate temporary restraining order because they said they were going to have more protests and they didn't want to be impeded. Mm-hmm. Well, they rescinded that request, and the protests did not occur, at least not in mass fashion. And so the rest of the suit remains in place, but it does not have a court date yet. So we will see, you know, if they press forward. Now, I should mention that the city and the police have provided a very lengthy and detailed account of their side about the injuries to the officers, the crowds getting out of control, and the damage and some of the looting that people saw on TV, and essentially said, look, other than the two nights when people got out of control, we didn't use forceful tactics. It was only as a last measure to calm the situation.
They say, the suit says, that the police repeatedly and persistently violated the constitutional rights of protesters and subjected them to unlawful physical contact and or restraint designed to frighten and intimidate the plaintiffs and to deter their continued exercise of their constitutional rights. Now, we all saw these protests in the aftermath of the Keith Scott shooting. We saw them on television, either live or on tape. And some of them did, in fact, get out of hand, but others were peaceful protests. And where they did get out of hand, they did use tear gas. I grew up in the 60s. This is not the first time tear gas has been used. So why now? Why would this be unusual now, any more unusual than it has been in the past?
Well, I think the argument in I'll let everybody else chime in, but I think the argument here is that the police have militarized themselves in terms of what they wear and their tactics, and that exacerbates tension that is already in the air. So that's the basic argument.
And I think you have to divide the protesters into two groups as well. There were people who were peacefully protesting, and there were also people who were looking to cause trouble.
Right.
There have been members of the Charlotte Clergy Coalition for Justice,
yeah,
who were among the protesters, but were not necessarily protesting. And some of those clergy members have also said that CMPD acted improperly in some cases.
So when will we have a disposition on this suit? When will we know the outcome? Anybody?
Well, I mean, they don't have a court date yet, so that's the next thing. When do they go to court? And then will these seven protesters, will they stick with it? Because, you know, this costs money. Now, they do have some nonprofit groups that are involved as well, but the attorneys did not return my calls, so I'm not exactly sure what strategy they have going.
Yeah, forward. I've actually talked with one of the attorneys involved in that, Luke Largesse, and what I gathered from him is that they are basically hoping to use this lawsuit as sort of a policy wedge or a lever to sort of help. In a sense, you could say it's a vote of no confidence in the city council's ability to sort of, you know, move the police tactics and police behavior in the direction that these protesters and people who are sympathetic with them feel it should go.
Well, those plaintiffs may not have a court date set yet, but we've had our day in court. Lisa Wharf has had her day in court. We'll talk about that when we come back, because that involves another CMPD video release. And we'll talk about what's going on with the still undecided governor's race. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Piedmont Plastic Surgery and Dermatology, featuring plastic surgeons and dermatologists performing cosmetic and plastic surgery procedures and skin cancer screening, serving Charlotte, Gastonia, and surrounding counties. Details at ppsd.com. And UNC Charlotte, presenting Exponential, the campaign for UNC Charlotte and opportunities it brings to the Charlotte region, the state, and beyond. UNC Charlotte, the power of you. Details at exponential.uncc.edu. Well, for Republicans, what was looking like very bad news before the election has become the best of all possible news. They took the White House, kept control of the House and Senate. Still, Donald Trump did not win the popular vote, and questions remain about how he will govern and how people will react. He also has made a lot of promises that may be a little difficult to fulfill. So what's next for the GOP? We talk about that on this program Monday at 9 with members of the party.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Donald Trump's transition gets off to a turbulent start. Hillary Clinton makes her first address since conceding the election. And Obamacare enrollment surges as Republicans vow to repeal the law.
The news roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
Prithee, methinks it's the local news roundup. That's one of our winning contestants in our little contest this summer, visiting musicians Eddie Farrell and Karen Jacob. Karen, at least, is in the studio. Eddie was on his way. We don't know where he is, but thank you for that. That's a very nice little take on our theme.
Yes.
Very nice.
Lisa Worf is with us from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher from QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer with the Charlotte Business Journal. And Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Now, speaking of days in court, as we were before we went to the break, there's a new law in North Carolina restricting the dissemination of police video, but there's a video that predates that change in the law that WFAE sued to get access to. And you've been filing some really intriguing reports, Lisa, on those efforts. Interesting because not only because of the subject matter, but because those reports follow you through the court system. If people haven't heard these, they should go to our website and listen to them, because you go through microphone in hand from beginning to end, including being in the courtroom and talking to the judge. Why first of all, before we talk about that, why were we so keen to get that footage? Why is it important?
Well, I mean, I think police shootings in general are pretty important footage. And you have all these body cams. The city council has decided to spend a lot of money on body cams. So there's certainly this heightened interest when there is body cam footage of a police-involved shooting.
Were we alone in these efforts? Because very often news organizations will band together and file suit for these things.
I petitioned alone, and that was pointed out. I mean, it was we wanted to understand what the process is, and you asked why we were trying to get this particular video too. Is, you know, part of that reason is because it happened all the way back in June,
okay.
The shooting, and it's been, you know, 5 months, and that's a long time. And, you know, the other part we realized is that, you know, the DA hasn't decided whether to charge the officers or clear them. And, you know, the officers are back on the street. So it is an intriguing case.
Yeah. I'm curious as to why and how they let you take a microphone through the entire process, because courtrooms particularly are sometimes not open to cameras and therefore not open to microphones. Why did they say yes?
I mean, I think there's folks who certainly understand the importance of transparency in the justice system. So I really didn't have a problem with that request. It was just trying to file this as quickly as I could. It took them a little while to, after the law was passed, to actually get the process down.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as far as recording, that was not a problem.
So you went into the courtroom yourself. You defended yourself. The station did not hire a lawyer to go in there and plead the case. Did you want to do it that way? Was that your idea, or we're a public station and we're poor and we don't have money for attorneys?
We talked about it. We talked about it, and actually it was I didn't realize until actually the morning when I went to make the argument that I had filed in the name of WFAE, and a corporation cannot be represented by someone who is not an attorney. So someone could have argued and said, you know, we want to dismiss this right away. But, I mean, we did it. The reason we did it is because we wanted to understand that process and what it would be like for a citizen who was interested in getting videos to go through, what it would take.
The outcome, we didn't prevail. The judge said that WFAE, therefore you, because you were the one representing us in the docket there, failed to show a compelling public interest to release the tape. Now, I listened to your report. I thought it was pretty compelling. Why did he come down on the other side, do you suppose?
Well, he said, he acknowledged. He said, hey, transparency, is axiomatic in the justice system. But there is an elevated interest when a video captures police shootings. But because the charges haven't come down or the officers haven't been cleared, CMPD has said they acted heroically, so they feel like it was pretty open and shut case, that this could impact the impartial carriage of justice, basically. I'm not saying the phrase how it should be said. And the argument from the attorneys of the police officers involved were saying this could, this footage could influence a possible grand jury, for example.
Most people listening will never go to a courtroom in real life unless they're called for jury duty. And the closest they'll get to one is probably watching something on television, CSI or something like that, where it's nothing like what really happens in a courtroom. So how prepared did you feel? How intimidated did you feel by the process? I would think that would be fairly intimidating.
Yeah, I was intimidated. I have to say everyone was very courteous during the whole process. But yeah, it is certainly intimidating to go up against five other lawyers on the other side. I tried to get some input from—
You mean they hired lawyers?
I tried to get as much input as I could from lawyers, but I didn't say very much. I mean, I think I spoke for about 2 minutes, but it's intriguing. And one of the things the judge pointed out was that the family of the victim was not in the courtroom,
right?
And I caught up with the grandmother of Rodney Rodriguez Smith. And, I was asking her, would she have felt comfortable with it? Did she want to see the video? It turns out the family does want to see the video. And so
they don't have the right to see the video?
No, CMPD under the new law can show them the video.
Okay.
If
they want to see it.
If they are allowed to do that, but they can also say, we don't want to show you it. And in that case, the family would have to go through the same process that I did. Mm-hmm. It would be free of filing and serving fees, which cost us about $300. But it would be going through that process.
I think one of the unintended consequences of your experience is that now CMPD says it may be the one to push for the release of future body and dash cam footage. That seems rather interesting to me. Why have they come to that determination?
Yeah, it's intriguing, certainly. And what Mark Newbold, the CMPD attorney, said to me is that he felt with this new process that they can argue what they feel is best for the department and the community. They don't have to weigh the concerns that the DA may have as far as if, their prosecutorial responsibilities, that is put on this third party, which is a judge. So they feel more leeway to do that. So we'll see how that works out. I mean, he said that they would like to push for sooner rather than later. I don't know exactly what that means, but it could possibly be while the DA is still trying to figure out what to do with officers. So we'll see. But he said certainly in police-involved shootings, things like pursuits, possibly use of force in general.
Well, now that you've decided to change careers and go to law school, we would suggest that
failed arguer.
No, maybe not. But you may want to take a look at the Charlotte School of Law. The American Bar Association has placed the Charlotte School of Law on probation and directed the school to come up with a written plan to bring it into compliance with certain codes, supply the bar with its admissions methodology, policies, and practices, and advise the public and its students of its probationary status. What's going on here?
Admission, or, well, the graduation or the passage
placement,
of the...
right?
Yeah, the bar. Yeah, it's the rates that which people are passing the bar exam are too low.
Yeah.
I think they're in the 40s.
I jumped ahead.
Or something.
Yeah, you're right. That's what leads to the placement, is what I was trying to say. Sorry.
And part of it's because they're admitted students who are not ready. What does that mean, not ready?
I'm guessing they did not score high enough on... Is that...
I mean, I think part of... Yeah, Charlotte School of Law has often said, hey, we take non-traditional students, and we take students that, you know, may not have great LSAT scores or things like that. But
LSAT's like the PSAT.
Yes, yes. But that are enthusiastic and are willing, and we want to provide them a way to do law. But, you know, that's tough then. I mean, a lot of, you know, and no one's disputing the quality of education there.
Because in the paper this morning, there was an article that referenced at least one student who I think is out of state who took an online course which led to a kind of a test to let you know how you might perform in law school. And she passed the test easily and then went to Charlotte School of Law and accumulated $30,000 in debt. And no, either didn't get a law degree or can't get hired. I've forgotten.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, you don't want to. Law school is not an inexpensive undertaking, and you sure don't want to go into that and spend all that money, only to wind up, you know, at a dead end without being able to pass the bar exam at the end. So
but you can't predict necessarily what the outcome of an education will be.
Well, but when you look at colleges just in general, you always look at, particularly when we're talking about law school, you look at things like placement and ratios and where people are winding up getting jobs. That's a big part of someone's decision of where they go. And obviously, if you then have to say that you're under these probationary measures, that is an unpleasant marketing aspect, to say the least.
Yeah. And I think I read somewhere that only 30-some percent of their graduates actually found jobs after graduation that required full-time jobs that required them to have passed the bar.
That's a brutal statistic.
And in that article you mentioned, you know, back in 2006 when they opened, you know, their first class, they had pretty good bar passage rates. It was 85%, they pointed out. And then, you know, you had the recession and, you know, it was incredibly – there was a glut of lawyers on the market, right? And so lawyers weren't – you know, people were not applying to law school as much. And so I think there's some thought, too, that they had to kind of expand their pool of who they would accept as those lean years went on.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of points back to this question that's often been raised about a law school, a private for-profit law school being in a city the size of Charlotte. A lot of people have often said that Charlotte should have a law school. There should be a medical school. Both of those things should be in a city this size. I mean, like a UNC state-sponsored law school and medical school. And we don't have either of those things. So I know economic developers have been for years and years pointing this out, that Charlotte is the biggest city of its size without a medical school in town, and that you know, hampers Charlotte's ability to be competitive in, you know, research and medical fields. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure those people will point to this again and say, you know, see, this should not even be, you know, the situation should not be this way.
And 5 to 7 years ago when they opened up, I mean, or, you know, I think a few years after they opened up, I mean, they got a high of, I think, about 1,400 students, which was the biggest law school in the state at that time. I mean, I think and now they're down to half the size. But I mean, law schools, I think, in North Carolina. Yeah, I mean, that's a big 1,400.
The point that you're making, Eric, though, is absolutely right. Charlotte Chamber and other groups have talked about this for years, and it has vexed them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on to the never-ending governor's race. The North Carolina gubernatorial race not over. Roy Cooper is apparently still ahead by around 5,000 votes, but Pat McCrory has not conceded. And, in fact, reports today that He's filed more complaints. One involves Mecklenburg County.
52 counties, I believe.
Yeah, 52 of 100 counties.
Of 100, yeah.
Latest complaints say ballots were cast by dead people, convicted felons, or by people who already voted. Who filed the complaints, and on what basis are they filing these complaints?
Well, you just cited some of the reasons for the complaints.
Why do they think? I guess that's the better way to phrase the question. Why do they think that dead people voted and that felons voted? Why do they think that?
Well, I think they're talking to elections people, correct?
And I suspected also that they're probably looking at names and then matching them against, you know.
Yeah.
And oftentimes we've seen in the past that when you do these types of initial sort of name comparisons and looking for places where, you know, a name appears in one list and in another list and go, oh, this looks funny, it often turns out that there's some reasonable explanation. It's someone with the same name, but it's not the same person exactly. And, you know, when you dig deeper, these things tend not to be quite as, you know, egregious.
But both of the campaigns have brought in very high-powered Washington elections expert attorneys to, you know, go after each side. And basically you have Cooper saying, look, I've won, it's over. And McCrory saying, no, this needs to be recounted. We see irregularities. And so this is going to go on into December.
So the McCrory campaign is suspicious of 90,000 votes in Durham County. And one of the complaints now involves Mecklenburg County and has to do with three voting machines that were taken out of service on Election Day. Is that true?
That's what I read. I think I read that in the Observer.
I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that because I'm always reading about voting machines being taken out for various reasons.
Grasping at straws, perhaps, or is there some valid concern for a reason for concern?
I don't think that we have enough information to really know what's in this. Just in general, these fights tend to often, as Eric said, there's not a lot of evidence of a lot of voter fraud. I mean, they're just nonpartisan study after nonpartisan study shows that. So we'll find out. But this is definitely going to be – no one is just conceding. That much is obvious.
So there's a deadline set for today for all these election boards to report in, and some of them are not going to be able to
– Many of them.
That's already gone.
Yeah, that's been extended.
Okay, so who will decide this complaint? Will it simply be decided by a recount at the various boards of election, or – will some other entity have to get involved before the end of this?
I think it's both. It could be both that and the State Board of Elections.
Yeah.
Okay. And potentially beyond that.
Once you get to the state, then Cooper or McCrory, depending on who's leading that point, would have 2 days to demand a recount. So then you go through that.
And then this has brought attention to a little-known provision in state law, which says that contested elections for top state officials can be decided by state lawmakers. And that would mean that the Republican-controlled legislature would make the decision. How likely would they be to decide against the Republican incumbent governor?
Well, I think I've seen something where someone
– Speaker Moore.
Tim Moore said that, you know –
measure of last resort or something to that effect.
Yeah, basically, that they'd rather not go there. But he didn't rule it out quite notably.
I mean, that obviously, no matter what was decided, that would be the ugliest way to go. So they need to figure out a way to do it before it gets to the legislature, I think.
And that would likely result in – litigation.
Right.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Democrat Mike Morgan surprised lots of Republicans in the government by unseating his opponent in the Supreme Court race, Bob Edmonds, who was a Republican, although I don't think – did it say so on the ticket what the political parties
were?
This would tip the balance of the state Supreme Court toward the Democrats, 4-3. But perhaps this race is also undecided because the Observer's Taylor Batten wrote of a rumored plan that would allow the legislature to pack the court in their direction – the Republican direction, by increasing its numbers. Where did that rumor come from? And in 20 seconds, how do you substantiate it?
Well, it's actually allowed by the state constitution. It says that the General Assembly can add as many as 2 people. And, you know, it's just something that's being, you know, talked about. That's the buzz. Whether or not that actually happens, and I think Jeff Tart said that that's an absolutely dumb idea, we'll see.
All right. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Elon University, committed to redefining higher education with more that matters, including study abroad, research, internships, and other intensive learning experiences. Details at elon.edu. And Our Town's Habitat for Humanity Restores in Cornelius and Mooresville. Restores offer donated household items to the public, with proceeds used to build affordable homes in northern Mecklenburg and Iredell counties. Details at ourtownsrestore.org. Donald Trump's transition gets off to a rocky start. Hillary Clinton makes her first address since conceding the election. And Obamacare enrollment surges as Republicans vow to repeal the law. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about on the national version of the Local News Roundup. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the International Hour follows at 11. Want to join our conversation? You can do it right now. Charlottetalks at WFAE.org. We're coming right back.
Next time on The World, residents of the Maldives Islands have watched rising seas swallow up their land. Now comes President-elect Donald Trump.
When you have a climate skeptic elected into office in one of the most powerful countries in the world, it does not send a very reassuring message.
Climate activists gear up for a global fight. That's on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. It's the Local News Roundup. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Lisa Wharf, reporter for and news director, assistant news director of, I just promoted you, WFAE News.
And attorney at law.
That's right. Let's go to the presidential election, which is certainly decided. Former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox became Secretary of Transportation in the Obama administration. Mel Watt, former local congressman, became director of the Federal Housing Agency, Housing Finance Agency in 2014. And now there are lots of local people being rumored to be considered for the Donald Trump cabinet. First, this really surprised me. I don't know why it did. I never thought about it. Tony Zeis, former president of CPCC, rumored to be on the short list to lead the U.S. Department of Education. He says he voted for Trump, but is this more than a rumor? Has he been called to New York? Has he been to
Donald? I think he did go to New York, I believe. Did I read that?
Did he? I'm not sure.
I heard he went to D.C.
For D.C.?
I know, yeah. Politico.
But then I didn't know anything else about why he was there. So.
But Politico obviously floated the rumor this week about him for education. I think the thing that jumps out at me, if that is legit, is here's a guy who ran a community college system.
Yes.
You're talking about an administration that wants to figure out a way to increase jobs, particularly more blue collar jobs, retraining, things like that. In that realm, he has a lot to offer.
Yeah. And that is kind of his thing. I mean, he's written books about that.
Sure.
So, yeah, I guess that's why he's on their radar. Yeah.
And he's really well respected in this area, for sure, for that.
And, of course, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and South Carolina Lieutenant Governor Henry McMaster may also be joining Trump. CNN reported that Haley everybody's reported now that Haley met with Donald Trump yesterday. What are they considering her for?
Secretary of State, they say, which is
But I think
kind
that
of
one
interesting.
Has been decided. I think I read on
Secretary
CNN this morning that
Well, I thought Mitt Romney was going to meet with him over the weekend to talk about Secretary
Sunday.
Of State as
yeah,
well.
That one's still up in the air.
Now, National Security Advisor, they settled this morning with Michael Flynn. I thought Nikki Haley, look, we all know she's a very popular governor, considered a rising star in the party, and I think in many ways could be a very good selection. But it seems to me commerce or something that's not international affairs, just because most governors don't deal with that. Right.
Yeah.
But, when you look at the way she's recruited business, I think Commerce Department is the one that sticks out to me that might be a better fit. But Mr. Trump has not asked me for my advice.
But they're all going after Nikki. Nikki Haley's frequently mentioned in the Republican Party as a rising star. Why not Pat McCrory? I don't mean that as a joke. Why not Pat McCrory?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question.
He and Mike Pence are acquaintances?
Who
knows?
And Governor McCrory has spoken highly of Mike Pence. So, depending on what happens with the unanswered election here. Maybe that's something that is talked about in the future. But I think Nikki Haley has, you know, several advantages. One is, you know, she is a different face for the Republican mm-hmm. Party. But the other is she has been such an effective communicator. I mean, when she did the response to the State of the Union, the way she handled the Confederate flag, the way she handled the floods, I think she's done a lot of things that have put her in a very positive light nationally.
But did she ever specifically endorse Trump?
No.
In fact, she came out against
Rubio.
That's what I thought. I remember that. And so I heard this and I thought,
So that's why I asked about Pat McCrory, because he has taken maybe people don't necessarily agree with his position on HB2, but he stood pat on HB2, and I mean, I don't mean that as a joke either, but he stood pat on that. He's firm. He also distinguished himself with the flooding down east, now the fires. Why not him?
But in comparison, I mean, when you look at the Mother Emanuel shootings and the Confederate flag and just what a difficult issue that is, and for a Republican governor in a southern state to handle it that well, I think that resonated a lot more, disrespect, than sort of, you know, these other items.
So Henry McMaster, we just talked about him possibly joining Trump, and I think one of us said possibly as attorney general, but Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions has been chosen as attorney general. So what might they now be looking at him for, if anything at all? Do we know?
No idea.
I don't know.
Mike Pompeo, who is described as a hawkish Republican from Kansas, former Army officer, has been named to head the CIA this morning, and he's been very critical of Hillary Clinton on the Benghazi committee. Who else? Let's see here. Dan DiMicco, former head of Charlotte-based steel company Nucor, who is leading the Trump transition team in a key trade area, could also join the administration. What's he doing? What might he end up?
Well, they're saying he might be have a chance at U.S. Trade Representative or Commerce.
Yes, and anybody who has followed Dan DiMicco when he was running Nucor, to say that he has strong feelings on trade would be a vast understatement. And so, you know, he and Donald Trump, I think, are right there. They agree on this issue, and so that would seem to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, his big thing is that we, in his mind, we are already in a trade war with China. So he basically, he feels like people like Hillary Clinton and, you know, I guess Barack Obama by extension have been sort of trying to tap dance around, you know, the confrontation that's already occurred. So I think he's...
And the other half of the Republican Party. Remember, there are many Republicans who favored TPP those other measures.
Sure.
But the Trump wing definitely does not. And so that's why Dan DiMicco would fit that.
Yeah. And his complaints about trade predate Obama by a long
yes.
margin.
Okay. Charlotte City Council this week voted unanimously to approve a $4.4 million in city and county property tax rebates for a Pappas property mixed-use project near Dilworth. This is the place on Kenilworth Avenue near the Metropolitan. That would be where the Charlotte Realtors headquarters used to be. But I took this out of the paper, the fact that they approved a $4.4 million city and property tax rebate, but they don't deal with the county taxes. Was that already approved by county commission?
I think that whole thing was sort of a piece, the city and the county. I think they were on sort of marching lockstep on that.
What will they be building, and how will it impact traffic? I'm really beginning to become very concerned that we are becoming Atlanta in spite of the fact that we say we don't want to be.
Are you going to yell, get off my lawn?
Traffic is a problem.
It's absolutely. A problem. Well, I mean, Mike, look, for 30 years we were building this beltway that is going to create what Atlanta has, right, where you have all this mushrooming traffic and development. But certainly it's going to add traffic to an area that is already congested. I mean, that's just a given. I think some of the criticism that I heard from council is about the affordable housing piece of it. And this is it seems to me that affordable housing has been a sleepy topic. You know, people kind of their eyes glaze over, like with school board. But affordable housing more and more is becoming – a central and crucial issue in this city. And when you look at some of the things in terms of income inequality and some of the protests, more and more, that is a central struggle that Charlotte is really, really having a difficult time figuring
out. And that's one of the things that city council said they'd be strong on after the Keith Scott shooting and the protests. Affordable housing, that they would speed up their plan to have something like 5,000 affordable units over
3 years.
Supposed to be 5 years, and then they cut it down to 3. Which, you know, I think I read in the Observer, it took them 14 years to get 5,000 previously. But, and so this really came under some scrutiny. The city council came under some scrutiny because, you know, this went through and yet there was no requirement for affordable housing.
Can there be a requirement with teeth in it? Do we have the authority?
Well, requirement is not the right word, but there was no sort of, okay, negotiating between, you know, we'll do these improvements if you can put some units in. And you know, the argument for not doing that was that this had been in the works for a long time and that this would mess up the plan.
Right. And, the city has run into this problem again and again. And in essence, I think what politically Charlotte is saying is, yes, we need more affordable housing. Yes, this is important. But when it comes down to the brass tacks of negotiating with a developer on a specific project, it tends to come unraveled and then the problem just sits there. Mm-hmm.
Katz has new streetcar smell fever. they want the city to buy 6 modern streetcars for the Gold Line. They were going to buy 7 and keep 2 of them as spares, but the build-out of the line itself, the bids for that, have come in much higher than anticipated. Is this request pro forma, or might they actually be turned down? I mean, if they build this line out, they're going to have more than the 2 old streetcars that have been running since, what, 1910? They're going to have more than that.
Those are replicas that they're using, yeah. But the answer is yes. I mean, look, the line is already operating. They're going to extend it. They can't refuse the cars because a big part of the pitch here is the new cars that make it feel like you're actually moving and moving with some acceleration.
You
don't want that sort of old-time San Francisco feel. You want people to get on and think they're moving from A to B so that it will be used.
Part of it. These cars that they want to buy are the Siemens S70 vehicles. These are the same cars that are used on the Blue Line. They're just smaller versions.
And they said these can actually run on the Blue Line too, if necessary. Really?
I love the Siemens S70. I just think it has a nice car.
Yeah. and these are hybrid cars, so they don't have to put the overhead wires everywhere because they can run for periods of time without the wires. They can run on battery power.
So we're going to have the Prius streetcar. It's pretty exciting.
I-77 toll lanes are encroaching on downtown Charlotte. What's going on? What kind of struggles might we anticipate as they start their work between 277 and 85?
So far, they've seemed to do a pretty – because I drive that way coming in here from the Huntersville area. And so far, they seem to be doing a pretty good job of keeping the construction from impacting traffic too badly. Mm-hmm. They're already building new lanes, but they're building them on the median, or on the shoulder, I guess I should say, and they've erected these concrete barriers to kind of keep the traffic away from the construction workers and vice versa. So far it's been okay, but I imagine it's going to get worse as they start trying to do, because I think they have to do overpasses
and
all that stuff, and that's going to be a nightmare.
I mean, the good thing is, first of all, Mike loves traffic, and secondly, I do wonder, with this governor's race, remember, Roy Cooper came out and said, if it was up to me, I'd cancel the contract. So if you become the governor, you're going to cancel the contract when all this is going on?
Someone who doesn't travel that route often, I was on it yesterday, and actually I was surprised by the effect of the traffic, but I was comparing it as someone who doesn't travel it often. So I wonder if maybe you've just kind of gotten used to it gradually increasing. But
it could be.
I thought we would get through an entire news roundup without mentioning the words HB2, but it's a day of the week, and so we must. HB2 is, in fact, back in the news with a Charlotte Chamber official saying it's cost heaven knows how many jobs, and this new information came from, get ready for it, emails. Step away from your emails, everybody, please. How did these emails come to light?
Well, the Observer had asked for, we did a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request for the emails, and we got them who did we get those from? Either the city or the state, one of the two. And they basically showed that CoStar company, when they were thinking about coming and bringing more than 700 good-paying, you know, blue, white-collar type jobs, their board pushed back. They, you know, it appears that the executives were really leaning towards Charlotte, but their board of directors weighed in and was like, well, all this, you know, all this stuff about this HB2, and we don't know about all that. We don't know about that. And they wound up sort of, you know, derailing the thing over HB2.
So what is this cache of emails that you've uncovered? Tell us that we did not already know.
Not a whole lot, just that HB2 is a very disruptive. I think it underscores what we already knew in a really dramatic and perhaps painful way that this is a real disruption.
Yet Forbes.com reports that as of November, with the month we're in, North Carolina is still the number two best state for business in the country. Will that help the brand?
Well, sure. I mean, that always helped. But North Carolina has always ranked high. I think what Eric is getting at is this debate between the governor and the commerce secretary saying that HB2 is having no impact, and they'll point to things like that Forbes survey. And then you have people who are actually on the ground, like chamber recruiters, saying, look, this is damaging. So that's sort of you have to sort that out as a citizen and see which way you feel about
that. Well, and now assuming the election results stand up, now you'll have an anti-HB2 governor and an assumedly anti-HB2 commerce secretary who will be saying this thing is a big problem. We need to get rid of this. And
with a veto-proof Republican majority in both houses or both chambers of the legislature. So it will be very interesting if that's the way it pans out. Yeah.
In the 90 seconds we have left, Hornets owner Michael Jordan is in line for the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That's the highest civilian honor you can get.
I'm not sure what to say about that other than congratulations, Michael.
Yeah, well, he's getting it with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in 1900.
My all-time favorite.
Tom Hanks, Bruce Springsteen.
Meanwhile.
Pretty interesting class.
Meanwhile, I'm on the Charlotte Observer's mobile app at the moment, and it says here, injury to Luke Kuechly, a blow his Carolina Panthers teammates felt. Panthers Luke Kuechly's scary injury shocked sports fans nationwide. No update on his condition this morning, but they think he may have a concussion from last night's game.
Yeah, they think a concussion. Yeah, it was
really devastating for us.
Yeah, and for him. I mean, he's had a history. He's got a personal history with concussions. He was out some, I think, last
year. Missed three games last year. And remember, he's not only one of the best players, not only on the team, but in the league, but he's one of the most popular. Everybody likes Luke Kuechly. So.
We definitely wish him well.
We won, but barely. 23-20 last night against New Orleans. So we end the week on some good news.
Positive note.
That's right. Eric Spanberg and Eric Frazier from the Business Journal and the Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Lisa Wharf from WFAE News.